This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
I did not imagine in my lifetime, I never imagined growing up that I would work in a nonprofit organization. It wasn't something that was on the horizon for me. And the first job that I had in my life that involved working with donors was at a parochial school, a fair-sized parochial school in Pennsylvania. And I had taught there first in the high school, and then later was hired to take the principal's position. One of the responsibilities of the principal at that school was a line item in the budget that was called contributions. And the principal, not the school board and not the school treasurer, was responsible to make sure that line item got filled. That meant being in charge of things like school sale committee and certain annual events and solicitations that took place during the year. That was a hard adjustment for me. At that particular institution, the budget was very tight. That contribution line needed to be filled, and it was my responsibility to fill it. Part of the way that that responsibility was filled was picking up the phone and calling people on a list. We didn't call randomly, we didn't call the general public, but we had a list. And when we were getting toward payroll every 2 weeks, and payroll's coming, and the secretary would give me a rundown. This is how short we're going to be on payday. And then I had to pick up the phone. And I remember the first time that came to be what I needed to do right then. First part of the year, when I first became principal, it didn't come into play because our school sale was early in the year. We had the summer tuition, which got us through the first month of school, prepayments on tuition. And then the school sale came, so you were kind of flush with cash for a little while till the school sale money ran out. But then about a month and a half after school sale, the deficit started appearing. And I knew what I had to do. I was instructed in advance by the outgoing principal how you do this. Never did it before in my life. And I remember well sitting in my office on a fall afternoon, a late fall afternoon, and I knew that today I had to call. I had to start picking up the phone and calling. How many of you have to call for contributions? Bless your hearts. Okay. I had to call. And I had my paper out, I had my list, and I'm looking at these names and the little biographical sketches I have there, and they did donor tracking, so we knew how much these people were capable of giving, and this is how much they gave. Typically, when you would call, you could get this many dollars out of him. So I'm looking at my list, and I am sweating bullets. I am not happy about what I have to do here, and I kept putting it off. I got to late afternoon. I have to get this done today. Payday's coming. In so many days. So I opened my bottom desk drawer. In my bottom desk drawer, I kept snacks. And I had a bag of Reese's Cups. I am partial to Reese's Cups. And I opened the bag of Reese's Cups and I made a resolution. I'm going to eat me a Reese's Cup and then I am going to call. Okay? I ate my Reese's Cup. And I was not ready to call. So if one Reese's cup is good for you, you know that two Reese's cups are really good for you. So I ate another one. And literally, at some point, I looked down and I had eaten every Reese's cup in one of those plastic bags you buy at Walmart, you know, with Reese's cups. I ate an entire bag of Reese's cups and I had not called. I did get the calling done. I am glad that is not part of my job anymore.
I consider now I have one of the best jobs in the world. I give away other people's money. We have a gift fund program, predominantly Groffdale Conference and older Amish donors. They don't have mission funds or mission boards in their churches, and they need help deciding where funds should go. And that's a 180-degree different job than looking at the phone and a list and a number, you know, that's a deficit that has to be filled by payday. Fundraising. There are things to do and things not to do. These are a few suggestions I've learned over the years. I don't believe all of what I'm going to cover today applies to everyone in the room here, but if you work in a nonprofit organization, you should care about how your organization relates with donors, and particularly if you're a board member, you should care about, remember what I said, not if your organization relates with donors, how your organization relates with the people that are supporting it. A couple of general thoughts to share with you. What does Scripture do? Think about the area of giving. Scripture pushes donors. A donor is just simply a person who's giving. Scripture pushes donors toward quiet, anonymous giving. Who do you think you are if you're going to push them in a different direction? In Protestant giving circles, there is a push toward donor recognition. And those of you who are in a nonprofit organization, if you go to a planned giving conference or you go to something put on by an organization that's helping nonprofits raise funds, or if you buy a book on the subject, you're going to find a lot of material that you need to be careful about. That material pushes you toward donor recognition, to honoring donors. And when Scripture pushes a donor toward quiet, anonymous giving, not letting the right hand know what the left hand does, I do just urge you to exercise an abundance of caution. Okay? At Anabaptist Foundation, in our gift fund program, we work with Amish and Mennonite families and businesses, and their reactions toward charities that seek to recognize donors, it's in a range. And the range is, I would say, it's from yuck to outright offense being taken. We don't just support Conserve Anabaptist Charities. Some of our money goes to community organizations, medical nonprofits, and things like that. And this might not just apply to you. I would urge you as a conservative nonprofit organization to avoid any public listing of your donors. Most donors do want to remain anonymous, but having these honorary lists of presidential level donors or gold level donors, silver level donors, bronze level donors. Donor recognition in the form of plaques and awards, that doesn't quite fit in our circles. One of our donors was supporting a Protestant organization, which I won't name. It's a name that some of you may recognize and had been giving for a little bit of time, a little while, and evidently they track donors. They keep track of who's giving, and his giving had reached a level that triggered a recognition in their organization, and they sent this nice picture for him to put on the wall of his business, and then people who come into his place of business would be aware that the owner of this business is a proud sponsor of XYZ charity. The Amish donor that this was sent for was offended. This is a nice piece. This is not a cheap piece here. This was framed in a print shop. The idea that I gave to your charity and you took part of my money and you spent it on something to give to me, deeply offensive. So we didn't respond, and that's something I might touch on later. When you offend a conservative Anabaptist donor, The bad thing is you'll never know it, because they won't tell you. But they'll stop giving. We stopped giving to this organization for that particular individual, and either he's caught in the system, or they're hoping to get him back, because what do they do a year after he quit giving? We get the next one. Okay. You track donors, that's good. That's great. Recognition of donors is an area where I really urge you to be careful. How do you respond when a donor gives? If it's a conservative Anabaptist donor, I would say if it's any donor, but particularly a conservative Anabaptist donor, gifts like that, don't even think about sending gifts to your donors. They do not want anything from you in return. Quite a number of the donors we work with do not permit, well, it's probably the vast majority, it's probably 97 to 98% of the donors will not permit their name to be attached to a donation. It's sent as an anonymous gift. They do not want you to so much as be able to send them a thank you letter. They don't want anything back in return for their gift. That is tying in with this right here, what Scripture pushes donors toward. Don't send gifts. Many of you do send a thank you letter, an acknowledgement letter. Those are good if. Some organizations send something that's obviously run off on a copy machine and 40 other people got this same little note. That's so obvious. If that's all you can do, don't do anything. You're better off not even sending it. Yes, the receipt needs to be sent. Okay, in this case, it's sending to us, but if a donor's interacting with you, you do need to send the charitable contribution receipt, and you do need to make sure that it has the information that it needs on it, and you can say thank you at the bottom and maybe sign it. But if you're in the habit of sending out these little form letters, oh, here's a receipt, grab a form letter off the stack and fold it up and put it in, save your paper and save your copier expense. Those don't do anything for you. What does do something for you? Little personalized notes, and somebody who has to be responsible for this. Something that's written in pencil or ink, obviously handwritten. And of course, you can't write big missives or reports in handwriting, but just a little post-it note with a little thank you for your support. And it's handwritten, God bless you, or a scripture verse. That's about the best you can do. Send something like that. Leave the gifts for the Protestants, and leave the mimeographed little pull it off the pile type thank you notes. Leave those for the charities that don't know any better. So don't use public recognition techniques to attract donors, but do what? I'm sorry. Don't fly by the seat of your pants in donor work. And this, I'm taking the focus off the donor now, and I'm looking back up the chain, okay? Somebody's responsible to manage contributions, manage your budget and your organization. A lot of organizations, unfortunately, that we interact with, it's obvious they do fly by the seat of their pants. They do not have a well-thought-out program of managing their finances within their charitable organization. Probably the person that's responsible for that is responsible for many other things and has a very limited amount of time to give to interacting with donors and keeping track of where the finances are. I would encourage you to work hard enough at managing your finances in your organization that you can do certain things. Solid management. If you have good financial management in your organization, I'll suggest four things to you that will be true about your organization. And I'm just going to plop them all right up there. I'll do it this way. Solid management is, it knows in advance when there's going to be a shortfall. Poor management is caught in surprise when there isn't enough money or manpower to finish a project. You know, a lot of this has to be on the pre-planning side when you're doing annual planning and your planning and your organization, what you are going to do this year and what you're going to try to accomplish for the Lord and your organization. And then plans always have to hit reality. They have to go through a budgeting process, and you have to look at the resources that are available, that you can project are going to be available. Solid management looks ahead. Solid management is tracking cost on a project. It's tracking the money that is coming in compared to what was expected to come in. And it can look 3 months down the road and come to a board meeting and inform the board of directors, you know, the project is on track and it's going clickety-clickety-click. But I just want to let you know that I can see that 3 months from now we might be in a problem on the money. The expenses are tracking 12% higher than what we had projected, or donations are running 20% lower than what we had expected. Do you do that sort of thing? Does somebody have the kind of a finger on the pulse of projects that you've got going? Solid management knows it's coming in advance. Poor management is caught in surprise. And what then? Good management can go to its board and tell them that there's going to be a problem before there is a problem. Nothing you have to worry about right now. You don't even have to discuss it or put it on the agenda tonight. I'm raising the flag 3 months from now, we might have a problem. And I'll be back next month with an update on how this is going. And by next month, we might have to look at trimming this project back a little bit. Or we might have to look at getting more serious about finding funding for this project. Poor management puts the board in a bad spot because it allows them to be surprised. Poor management comes to board meeting and says, we're out of money. That we're 3/4 the way through and there's no money to finish. And all of the kind of the heavy hitters who we were kind of counting on to give, they've all already given. And it wasn't what we were expecting. Another difference between solid management and poor management. Because good management is looking down the road and they can see there's going to be a problem a couple months from now, then they can talk to the staff, the program people, the missionary in the field, and they can say, well, it's not what we were hoping for, and it's going to be a shortfall, and we need to start trimming back now, incrementally. And I think it's going to be about a 10% cutback, or maybe it's going to be a 50% cutback. If it's going to be a 50% cutback, you better be talking to them 1 or 2 months into the project. Okay? But you can tell your staff in advance that we might have a problem here, and let's do a little team exercise here. What are we going to do about this? Can we save some money by tweaking the program a little bit, changing its direction? Poor management doesn't inform the staff down below that there might be a shortfall and has to come to them later and say, this project's in trouble. Or, you know, this thing that you've talked to all the local people about, you've gotten them excited about, money runs out next month. That's poor management. It makes the staff members to feel like, well, whose fault was this that it isn't working out? That we've built all these expectations maybe on the mission field for the local church group that we're going to be able to do this, and now it's not going to happen, and I'm the one who told them that it's going to happen. And now I'm the one that has to go back and tell them it isn't going to happen. I'm the bad guy. I'm to blame for what happened here. Good management, because it looked ahead and it saw problems coming about 3 months down the road, it can reach out to donors, whether it does it in a public way through the newsletter, or it does it in personal phone calls to Jake and to Sam and to whoever you're talking with about this project, who cares about it. And it reaches out to donors with a plan. We did run into a problem, but this is how we plan to fix it. We're trimming back this part of the program, and we are going to need to raise an extra $12,000 to bring this to fruition. But when they come to the donor, they're coming with a plan and not just with an emergency appeal. Poor management is always in their newsletters and phone calls and conversations. They're always talking about urgent needs and emergencies.
Okay? Well, why are they urgent and why are they emergencies? Because you got poor management running the thing. They didn't see trouble coming down the road. Please don't depend on print advertising. This does not apply to everyone, but I think it probably applies to most of you in the room here. Print advertising is the cheapest and very least effective way to reach serious donors. It is the cheapest and the very least effective way to reach serious donors. And I've got a caveat on this. If you are a big organization and you can afford in your nonprofit organization to have people that it is their job to raise funds, to do marketing, to produce churnout materials, to keep track of donors, you've got a department that does that, then print advertising is a very effective tool for you. But if you are a smaller organization and everybody in your organization is wearing three or four hats, and there is somebody who one of their several hats is to relate with donors, you're simply not going to be able to do an effective enough of a job to depend on print advertising. We're going to talk a little more later about a better way to reach donors. It's personal work. Do you know that personal work costs a lot of money? And it costs something that's more valuable than money. That's time. Personal work is going to reach? No, not really. Personal work is going to somebody's house. And personal work is taking your laptop and going for supper at an old order Amish family's house, and after supper showing the slides from Mexico or Haiti or whatever to them and their children after supper while everyone's eating ice cream. That's personal work. That's how you connect with serious donors, with people that aren't casual donors, and maybe they give and maybe they don't. These are people that if they have anything to give, you're getting it because they're connected with your organization. How many of you do personal work? Don't raise your hand. Personal work is worth a whole lot more than a stack of newsletters this high. Right here, for those of you who don't have a marketing department. Please don't, do's and don'ts, please don't rob Peter to pay Paul. You know, in one sense, we say we're all in this together, we're all in kingdom work, we're all working for God, but I've got my budget and you've got your budget. And I need money for our programs and you need money for your programs. And I think the type of ministries that are at reach here don't cover the entire constituency we would serve. There'd be many that we serve that aren't represented here, maybe more conservative ministries or ones that aren't maybe religious in nature particularly. But the ministries that are related here, there is something that I think is true about a lot of you. And what I think is true about this lot of you is that there is this pond that you're fishing in for support. And I call it the Middle Mennonite Pond. That's probably not in the dictionary. It's a term we kind of use on the inside here. What's Middle Mennonite? Middle Mennonite is Keystone, Mid-Atlantic, Midwest, Charity, Beachy, Weaverland Conference, those types of Mennonites. For us, they're in the middle. They're not the Washington Franklin Conference, Eastern Nationwide Fellowship. They're not the Old Order Grofdales or Old Order Amish. They're not the Lancaster Conference or the Liberals. They're those Mennonites that are in the middle. And there are a lot of fishing poles sticking out into that pond. And there is a characteristic about Middle Mennonites that they tend to have pet charities or favorite charities. A charity that their dad gave to this same charity
or still does. They grew up in a home where gifts were made to this charity and this charity's newsletters were laying on the coffee table. They went to this charity's events and suppers and whatever it put on. They go to a church that supports certain, okay, maybe their keystone, and they always, of course, will support Olive Branch because that's the keystone mission. Okay, Middle Mennonite is an overfished pond. Too many fishing rods sticking in there. Now, there's plenty of money in the Middle Mennonites, but there's a lot of competition for it. And I look at it kind of like a pie that's divided up. And to get more of it, do you know what essentially you're doing when you get more Middle Mennonite money? You're taking a little bit of somebody else's piece of the pie. If the money was going to go to charity, but it's a fixed amount, you know, of discretionary giving that's going on, and every dollar you get is a dollar that didn't go somewhere else. And that, there really is something about that that is untrue. There is untapped potential there. But you're fishing mostly in a Middle Mennonite pond, and be aware of that. I wish you were aware of how big the ponds are that have bigger fish, that there are no hooks dangling in front of the fish. There are disposable funds available for charity, but they're most likely not in the Middle Mennonite pond. Please do.
What?
Please do communicate well. How do you communicate well with donors? And just three little rules of thumb. You think about how your organization communicates with donors, and you stack it up to these three basic principles. Do you have regular communication with donors? Is it systematic? And is it simple? Regular refers to the time frame. How regularly, if I'm a donor to your organization, how regularly do I hear from you? Do I hear from you once a quarter when the quarterly newsletter comes out? Do I hear from you one time a year when there's an appeal letter that comes out in December? How regular is it? It is important that communication is regular, because if it is not on some sort of a fixed schedule in your organization, then the busy people who are wearing many hats, if you're one of these little small organizations that doesn't have a fundraising department, communication's going to get missed because someone's going to be busy when it's time to get the newsletter out, and it's not going to quite get done in a timely manner. Systematic, I mean something different by that. I mean, do you have a plan in advance what you're going to talk to people about when you communicate with them? When you do your annual planning one time a year, which I trust you do, before your year starts, people who work, your board members have sat down together, you planned out what we're going to do this year and how we're going to do it. Did you also plan out when you're going to talk to the donors and what you're going to tell them? What we're telling them in the January newsletter and what we're telling them in the April newsletter, and then what we're going to tell them in the summer newsletter, and then what they're going to hear in the fall newsletter. Is that planned out? Or is it, oh, you know what, it's time to do the April newsletter, and you sit down at the keyboard and you're like, oh, we'll tell them about this. Okay? Do you have regular communication, and is it systematic? Have you got it planned out? And is it simple enough? There's one organization here in Lancaster County. It is not specifically a Amish Mennonite organization, although it's Amish Mennonite on the board. They have a newsletter that they send out, and I know the lady that does their newsletter fairly well. And I simply sat down with her one day and I said, your newsletter is useless. It's useless to Amish and Mennonite donors, because this charity works kind of in a specialized little field. I can't say too much, you know who they are. And when you read it, it's written for people that do what they do. And it has all these technical terms and little blurbs in it that, you know, I know our people. It's chunk, chunk, chunk. You know, you look at the first page and you pitch it, because I can't even read that, okay? I don't mean this literally, but you need to be able to communicate in Pennsylvania Dutch, okay? You need to be able to tell simple stories that have meaning to them. And simple stories that have meaning will do far more for you than anything else you can share with donors. I'd like to encourage you to communicate well. And Gary Miller, the Gary Miller that works with the SALT program, wrote that book, The Other Side of the Wall. How many of you have or have read that book? Okay, the rest of you, you need to read that book. That is one of the best books that has been written about charity work and our people. I don't know of a better one. Okay? It's a home run.
What was the name of
the Other Side of the Wall. I have that title correct, John?
Yeah, that's right.
The Other Side of the Wall. In that book, one of the distinctions that Gary explains is the difference between critical needs and chronic needs. You need to understand the difference between a critical need and a chronic need in whatever people group you're serving, whatever mission you're accomplishing. And then you need to be able to communicate those differently to people, the people you're reaching out to for support. And we'll stop right there, say nothing else. You have to read the book to get a little more on that. Communication is important. You need to communicate changing circumstances. How many of you have ever started a project and till you were done with that project, it was not what you thought it would be in the beginning? Okay, well, that's all of us. Because we start and then we learn as we go. And it's not always because of bad planning. Sometimes it is because there was bad management or bad planning that the project had to evolve into something else. But God does introduce curveballs and things that we weren't seeing up front, and we learn to work on our feet and try to be nimble and change. But when you do need to change something that you've communicated to donors, you need to communicate that you're changing and why you're changing. And this is a shortfall that I see in newsletters that come out from organizations similar to what are represented here. That a project gets represented in the newsletter, this is an urgent need, this is what we need to do, and we've got this plan to address this need. Boom, boom, boom. And maybe the next newsletter, it's there again, you know, soliciting contribution from donors and telling them this is what we're going to do. And then maybe the next newsletter, they're starting to talk about how it's getting implemented and we did this first step here. And then all of a sudden, it's like a big black hole opened and the whole project dropped in and there's never another mention of it because it didn't work out. And it's embarrassing to talk about failures. And sometimes it was an internal failure, bad management, and how do you ever explain that we didn't plan well enough? If you are ever doing anything in your organization and it's not working out as you expected, be honest enough to go back to your donors and say, this is what we told you we were going to do, and then this is what we ran into, and this is how we're changing it. Now you come back with a plan. This is how we're planning to change this, but you do come back and you communicate change to donors. It's something that's very important for them to see. Donors are looking for solutions. Most donors in our circles are what? They are successful
businessmen.
So do they know about problems? Yeah. Do they know about things that didn't work out as they planned? Yeah. Do they know how to adjust and make changes? Yeah, they do. So it's not so bad that you run into problems that you need to talk to your donors about, but it's pretty critical that when you talk to donors about problems, you're giving a well-thought-out, not fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants response. This is what we're doing to fix the problem. And you'll gain a lot of appreciation from donors if you communicate with them that way. In your organization, it should be somebody's job to know who supports your organization. Okay, sometimes I've gone in to help a little organization, and they're struggling financially, and I'll say, give me your donor list. We don't have a donor. Okay, who gives to your organization? Name, address, okay, all the pertinent contact information, but church affiliation? What's their connection to your organization? A little note line there. Did they have a son that served here in voluntary service 23 years ago? Okay, are you tracking donors? Do you know how much or what different donors give? And we don't do this for the purposes of glorifying one or the other,
But do you know, if I was at your office and you were at your laptop, could you spit out the names of everybody who's ever given you $10,000 or more? Bang, 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 and read right down the list and the dates that they gave it and how far apart those 10,000 or greater gifts were. Do you have the list of donors that have given you between $5,000 and $10,000, $1,000 and $5,000, less than $1,000? Do you know every donor? Can someone in your organization identify every donor who ever wanted to give a gift of stock or real estate to your organization? Okay, you need to be able to track donors. You should be able, if you track donors, be able to see when particular donors give. That's a list I was given at my first job there. These are people, here's the list of people that in December when you send a solicitation letter, these are the people who typically respond, and then year by year, this is how many dollars came in from them. Okay, so I'm looking on this list here and I'm seeing Jake King's name on the list right there, and December after December, $1,000, $1,000, $1,500, $1,000, $1,500. Jake's probably good for about $1,000, okay? Because I'm tracking, I can see. So when I'm doing my planning, I can see here's a donor that always responds. So long as he connects with us and we connect with him and there's mutual trust, we know what to expect. When they give and why they support, that why is very important. Why do people care about you? Why do they give to you? Is it because they've been on one of your projects? Is it because they've had a son serve in the organization? Is it because they've got a heart for Christian schools? Why do they give to your organization? Is that somebody's job to know those sorts of things? You track donors, the real why behind it is because you want to know when somebody quits supporting you. You want to know, not because you miss their money. Why do you want to know? Not because I miss Jake's $1,000, but because if Jake was supporting us every December with $1,000, and all of a sudden I look down and Jake didn't give us $1,000 last December and he didn't give us $1,000 this December, why didn't Jake give us any money? Now, maybe something changed in Jake's circumstances. That happens. And if you know, if you're doing personal work with your donors, you probably know well enough if they had a financial reverse or their business is doing badly or ill health or something like that. But I have found it really true, especially among the more conservative donors, that they look at their money as their vote. They don't sit on your board. They're not invited to help make you decisions. They have one vote on your organization. And that's their money. And when they give, they're voting for you. And when they stop giving, they are voting against something you are doing. And if I have offended somebody who is a good supporter of my organization, I would want to know why. What did we do? And it can be simple as things like this. This happened about 3 years ago. A certain organization was represented at a church gathering where a lot of people from a certain church affiliation were there. And just like out here, there was a display room, display boards, and people milling around, looking at the pictures. And it was during a break time, so there weren't a lot of people there. Somebody was going around, and they were looking at this display board from this particular organization, and they noticed that there were pictures pasted on top of some other pictures on the display board. And being curious, they looked behind. That organization has a mixed support base. Liberal Mennonites and conservatives. They were in a conservative venue. They had covered up all the pictures of their staff wearing ties with plainer looking pictures. Someone was irate. Did they already know that it was a mixed constituency? Yes, they already knew that. But the fact that you will disguise who you are depending on who you're talking to, they were in deep, deep trouble. And you know what? That type of donor in our circles, they will never call and complain. They will never tell you, you offended me. But I will die and rot before I will give you another dime because you have offended me.
That's why you track donors. That's the only reason. Not because you miss their money, but because you miss their participation. And if they're not supporting you, you need to know why. Just in wrapping up here, I want to make sure I get to this. Your resources, no matter whether you're big or small, your resources for connecting with donors are limited. You don't have unlimited time to sit down and talk to people. You need to know there are basically three types of donors out there. There are core donors, core constituency. These are the people that if these people from these churches quit supporting your organization, just shut the door. You're done. You're finished. If they don't give you their young people, if they don't give you their money, you're done. Affinity donors, there is a connection to you. Maybe it was a grandchild that went to VS there. And they give whenever you motivate them. If you ask them for money, they'll give. These people right here will give without you asking. These people right here, you ask and they will give because they do have a reason to give, but you have to ask for it. These people right here don't have a heart connection. It's kind of pitiful to see some nonprofits that chase these around. These are the people that go after the $15 oil changes for their school sales or benefit auctions from local community businesses. It's not worth your time. Spend your time having breakfast with somebody that's up here. Don't chase a $15 oil change. I think we're about out of time there. Relationship is trump in talking with donors. Understand that heart and checkbook are connected, where a person's heart is. That's where their treasure's going to be. You only want people whose hearts are with you. And please understand, most of the people who support our organizations are giving out of their paycheck. They're tithing. They're giving a certain amount of their discretionary income. That's paycheck giving. And it doesn't fluctuate a lot. If they get a little poorer, it goes down. If they get a little richer, it goes up a little bit. Most nonprofits are not getting gifts from this right here. Only the bigger ones are, by and large, the longer, more established ones. In every Mennonite community, there's a pile. And that pile's been building for 200 to 300 years. It's the accumulated wealth of generations. It's in land and businesses and in equity. Most charities, they live and die on paycheck money. There's a whole lot more money in the pile than on the paycheck. How do you get paycheck pile money? You have to do planned giving work. And to do planned giving work, if that's beyond your capacity as a small organization, you can come talk to us at Anabaptist Foundation, and we exist to serve you. We don't have programs and services of our own, but we'll help your donors find ways to give real estate to you and other things that they can pull off the pile. I'm going to stop right there.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.